Good morning, everyone. Welcome to Husky Nation News right here on Wuss Tours 91.7 FM. This broadcast is in collaboration with the UConn newspaper, the Daily Campus, and UConn student-run TV station UCTV. I am your host, Jonathan Kapeliovich. Now here is the news of the University of Connecticut from this week. If you're a student currently taking virtual classes, you might be interested in knowing what your professor can see you doing through the screen during class. Grace McFadden reports for the Daily Campus that on Blackboard, which houses the Husky CT page that UConn students are familiar with, professors have a bunch of analytics at their fingertips. For instance, professors can see how long students took a test for and how much time they spent on each question of that test. With more than half of UConn's classes this semester having been taught online, I'm sure many of you are familiar with Respondus Lockdown Browser, which is a program that tracks where students are looking during an exam and can flag for cheating. It does this by actually filming the student taking the exam. Kaltura, which is Blackboard's video capture system, allows professors to see how long students spent watching recorded lectures. Speaking of UConn Tech, the PeopleSoft student admin update began yesterday and will continue until Wednesday, December 9, leaving the system unavailable as the upgrade proceeds. According to Michael Mundrain, UConn's Vice President of IT and Chief Information Officer. Thomas Alvarez from the Daily Campus reports that the update was originally announced on November 17, but an update was provided just a week after through the Daily Digest. Mundrain said, "A key member of the project left suddenly for personal reasons right before a preparatory dry run, and this has introduced the delay." Mundrain assured that this delay should not throw the project off track too much, and he hopes that students will remain excited for the new updates to come. In the past, students have expressed a desire for an updated version of PeopleSoft Student Admin. Mundrain said that the team is going to complete the appropriate prep work to ensure a smooth rollout of the new update. On November 20th, the Rainbow Center held a virtual ceremony in honor of Transgender Day of Remembrance to raise awareness and remember those who have been victims of transgender violence. Daily Campus reporter Megan Shaw writes that this year in the U.S., at least 34 transgender people have died due to violence of this sort. Ceremony organizers read the names of each of those victims and led the attendees in a moment of silence to pay tribute to the victims and those impacted by transphobic hate crimes. The first Transgender Day of Remembrance was held in 1999, and since then, the number of hate crimes reported against transgender people has more than doubled, according to the LGBTQ+ Commission of San Mateo County in California. The day was originally started by transgender advocate Gwendolyn Ann Smith to mourn the death of Rita Hester, a black transgender woman killed in 1998. UConn economics professor Thomas McKelly focuses work on eminent domain, exploring why the government should have the power and the right to remove private property for public use. Grace McFadden reports for the Daily Campus that eminent domain is a field of economic law that focuses on the Fifth Amendment, where courts have interpreted that the government has the power to essentially take private property from citizens without their consent. McKelly said, "Are there limits on it? How does it affect people's investment in their property? Is that really important for the creation of public goods? Those are the sort of questions that I look at." Eminent domain can be used to take dinosaur fossils found on private property. It also comes into play when people find shipwrecks. But McKelly said that the law is not as clear due to the maritime salvage law, stating the compensation is due to someone who rescues things at sea. McKelly said he enjoys finding problems within law solutions that he could never dream of. He said, "There's an endless supply of interesting topics there for me as a scholar." To wrap up this week's news, here's the weather forecast for those of you in the Storrs and Mansfield area. Today will be mostly cloudy with a high near 50, and this evening will bring with it a 40% chance of rain and temperatures in the high 30s. We've got some rain likely tomorrow morning, with the day remaining cloudy with a high near 45. Tomorrow night will be rainy still, with a low of 33 and a chance of rain-snow mix into the early hours of Sunday morning. Sunday brings a high chance of rain and some showers before 10 a.m. and some more afternoon showers throughout the day, giving us a high of 41. We'll finish off the weekend with a mostly cloudy Sunday night with a low around 27. Hang tight, we will be right back with the rest of our show.
It's no secret that the HUS in WHUS comes from the University of Connecticut Huskies. The W is just because we're on the east side of the United States. It's a radio thing, you don't need to understand it. This is WHUS Stores, UConn's Sound Alternative.
As we move into our discussion segment of the show, please note that from this point forward, the views and opinions expressed on this Woods News Department show are those of the hosts and guests, and are not necessarily the views of the staff, management, or licensee of Woods Radio or the University of Connecticut.
Hello, this is Jonathan. I'm speaking with Sean Smith, CEO of Don't Diss My Ability Consultation Services. Hey, Sean.
How you doing, Jonathan?
So today we'll just be having like kind of a brief conversation about neurodiversity, your experience with it, and also my experience with it, because I also have ADHD and I'm high functioning, or have been diagnosed with high functioning on the autism spectrum. So yeah, let's get into this. So for our listeners, a lot of them are neurotypical. They don't know what it is like to be neurodiverse or what it means. So to you, what does it mean to be neurodiverse? What does neurodiversity mean?
Neurodiversity to me represents a group of individuals with a disability label, but for whom the term disability doesn't quite fit because our assets exceed any deficits we experience.
So it's like a gift almost. It is a gift.
Another way of framing it, like if somebody were to disclose to me that, you know, they were on the autism spectrum or have ADHD or, you know, another invisible learning disability, the first thing I say is, welcome to the world of the uniquely gifted. I truly believe that.
Well, what are some of your gifts? What do you think are some of your gifts?
I think it's important to also note, Jonathan, that like I'm still discovering mine. So I don't want people to think that this is a one-time thing and then it's over and it's done. I think that gifts can kind of comes in ebbs and flows, but it's through trying different things that you stumble upon or discover these gifts. It's kind of by putting yourself out there. So for me, one of my largest gifts is being an empath, which means that I sense and feel the world more deeply than others. And it also helps me to read people's energy and body language. I make people nervous sometimes. I can walk into a room and within moments of observing someone, I can tell how authentic and genuine they are. So I have a really good read on people. And it's a blessing, but it's also a curse, right? Because it makes it a pretty lonely world when you can kind of see through people for who they are. So that's one of my gifts. Another is, you know, and this is not exclusive to me. None of these are exclusive to me, but I'm kind of a big picture thinker. I call us macro thinkers. Sometimes where we have challenges are the micro processes or processes that need to happen in order for that big picture thing to all kind of come together. But I would say innovation, communicating with people, reading people, and self-awareness, I think, is another one of my gifts. I'm an open book. Like, I'm very self-aware about who I am and who I'm not. You know, things that I've stumbled into that are kind of cool that relate are, you know, dabbling in social media. I have no formal training in social media, but I taught myself how to use all the different platforms. Well, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And things kind of blew up on Twitter. One of my advisors, he stepped down a few months ago, but he was the show publicist for the Oscars. I have a celebrity brand ambassador, Eileen Gruba, who's been on Sons of Anarchy, Nip Tuck. The Watchmen, I think, was one of the most recent things that she's been on. So it's kind of been interesting how part of my gift is communicating and sharing my story, and then people find me and want to kind of promote and share that story because everybody loves an underdog.
Yeah, I was actually kind of wondering, like you mentioned, like some of your gifts are being an empath and communication and big picture thinker. Does that kind of play into why you chose to be kind of a neurodiversity initiative consultant?
No.
I don't know. Because it seems like, you know, like this big picture kind of like systemic reform, like almost like one company at a time, you know, like we're going to make the world a better place.
No, and I think, again, to kind of go back to the initial thing of, you know, it's not always a linear process. Like, I've had 21 different jobs. You know, I've done everything from shovel crap to work at McDonald's. I worked as security at a nightclub. I was a sheriff's officer for a brief time, or two murder trials. I was a therapeutic foster parent in the state of Maine. I was a blackjack dealer in Lake Tahoe. I worked at residential treatment facilities for at-risk youth. I was a therapeutic foster parent. So I've done a lot of different jobs and draw from a lot of different experiences, but I would say that my path to where I'm at now looks a lot more like a Plinko board than a straight line.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, I kind of feel the same way. I've worked for 2 years at McDonald's. It wasn't supposed to be that way. I was going to do it for 3 months, but it just ended up becoming longer. I volunteered for like a solar panel company, a film festival, a prison at one point. So I kind of feel the need. In my case, I just bounce around everywhere. A place gets boring if I'm not interested, if they're not doing interesting work, at least in my perspective, for a while.
That's great. Like I think people's loyalty should be more to themselves than to their employers, and ask yourself, what do you get out of your work? You know, like I've never been fired from a job, but I always left it better than it was when I got there. So I've always kind of taken on the challenge of how do I put my stamp on this and make it better?
Yeah, so I've honestly never heard of that before, because people always kind of emphasize, at least in America, loyalty to a company, and you want to like move your way up to the ranks. And I don't want to move my way up through the ranks. I want to be doing good work wherever that may be.
Well, I think part of that is a generational thing. I mean, I'm 43, and you know, growing up, my parents told me, you know, like if you have a university degree, you'll be set. That was lie number one. They told me that, you know, you'll find that one job and that's going to be your forever job. That was also a lie. And they told me in Canada and in New Brunswick, we're a bilingual province, so it's important to speak both official languages, English and French. And I am bilingual. I do speak French. I'm fluent in French. But again, that was lie number three. So all of these things that our parents had dreamed up for us based on their past experience and where they thought the future was headed, all those things seem to lead to security for them, and their wish was kind of forced upon us, and this was just kind of the way of thinking. But the reality is that that's not the case. And you know, one of the reasons why I love having conversations like these is ensuring that I had 21 jobs to kind of normalize that for people, because I think a lot of people who are neurodiverse who bounce around a lot think, you know, what's wrong with me? And I don't think there's nothing wrong with me. I got, you know, I would get bored and move on to find something more interesting to do, rather than just kind of staying around. I've moved a lot too, and I think that's part of the experience is moving and trying new things and being in different places and having new experiences. But, you know, you mentioned McDonald's. A lot of the friends that I made at McDonald's when I was in high school, I'm still friends with, and to see, you know, and they are kind of what I would refer to as assets in my network that I can lean on and tap into as different resources at different times, which is pretty cool.
I mean, yeah, kind of you build that network out of your 21 jobs or however many life experiences you had. No, so I was wondering, like, I remember, I think on one of the, I listened to another podcast episode. I forgot which one it was, but I think you were talking about like difficulties you had in high school.
Yes.
About credits, academia, and I was just wondering if you could speak a bit more to that that experience.
Sure. So it's kind of, you know, I always enjoy telling the story, but I kind of refer to my there's pre-diagnosis and post-diagnosis, and I kind of refer to the pre-diagnosis as the Neanderthal phase, less evolved. and so a lot of it was life lessons growing up. I mean, my challenges primarily were academic, but also rolled over into relationships. No matter how hard I tried, it never amounted to any form of success academically in elementary, middle, or high school. High school was definitely the worst. That's where I really stumbled and hit the most roadblocks. Back then, high school consisted of grade 10, 11, and 12. It took me 4 years to finish what should have been 3 years of high school. 32 attempts during the 18 credits required to graduate, including failing grade 10 math four times. So when people ask, you know, what was life like before I was diagnosed and started taking medication, it was hell. It really was my version of hell. And I experienced a lot of anxiety, which led to depression because I would constantly lie to my parents about academics because I knew I was going to get in trouble and I just wanted to delay the inevitable. And I joke, I became the world's best worst liar. I mean, even when I was caught dead to rights, I would still lie. You know, so I didn't give my parents a whole lot of hope or inspiration. In fact, if you'd asked my parents which one of me or my siblings would have gone on to post-secondary, I'm pretty sure it would have been my brother, my sister, the cat, the dog, and then me. My parents, like I mentioned, you know, I went to McDonald's so I could get out of working for my family business. My parents actually grew a branch of that thinking, what the heck are we going to do with Sean? So they really thought that at some point I was going to need to take that over out of necessity because I wouldn't be able to find anything else. You know, the irony now is that I'm the only person in my immediate family who has a Bachelor of Arts degree and also a master's degree. So it's, you know, you can't always tell how things are going to work out when you're that young.
I kind of feel that. I was diagnosed when I was very young, so life was admittedly a lot less painful for me because of counseling and medication, but it's still to the point where one of my parents is a hospital administrator and I'm going to school being an art major. You mentioned earlier that that getting a degree will lead to a job, and it's kind of funny that the spread, you know, the rumors in art is that, oh, it's one of the only degrees where we won't get a job. So they're very frank about it, which is kind of funny. But it's to this kind of, you know how you said you struggled pre-diagnosis and admittedly had anxiety and depression. Did any of that stem from the environment not being especially accommodating to neurodiverse people and different styles of learning, even if they're not diagnosed, even if they don't know that they're neurodiverse?
Absolutely. And I think it's important to acknowledge too, you know, my parents fought to keep me out of special education because back then special education was different. You were segregated and it really limited your future in many, many, many ways. But I mean, looking back, there are a lot of things that could have been done differently. Ultimately, it was medication that kind of unlocked my brain, which took my thought process from dial-up to fiber op. But I recognized that there were definitely, you know, and this is something I do talk about, is, you know, I just had a total brain fart, man.
Well, it's okay. Take your time. Unless you want to come back to it.
Can you remind me where we were headed with that?
How much of the environment, because the environment is not accommodating towards neurodiverse people, especially during your childhood?
Sure. Yep. So it kind of reminds me of, you know, trying to do schoolwork at home. And because, my siblings did better than me, but they were by no means, you know, scholars. You know, they none of us were gonna make the dean's list, let's put it that way, or get honors. But my parents got so frustrated with all of us for doing so poorly that they started a rule where for 2 hours a night, regardless of whether or not we had homework, they'd make us sit at the dining room table for 2 hours, and we would jockey for position because there's a hutch in the corner. And off the hutch, you could see the reflection of the big screen TV and my parents in the other room watching Jeopardy and Wheel of Fortune, right? So I realized that I can do this or I can do that. So being in that type of environment where there's a lot of stimuli and there's a lot going on, there's a very low chance that I'm going to be able to get into what I'm doing. But again, at the time, I didn't know that. I really was kind of just in my own head a lot. In my own world, I kind of describe it as being the main character in my own movie. And anytime somebody wanted my attention, it was like they had to pluck me out of there and insert me into a someplace foreign where I was expected to be able to pick up where they left off. And I wasn't able to do that.
So this has been in my head for like a couple of years, and I don't know how to interpret it. So the social model of disability, or the charity model of disability, right, is the view that neurodiversity, it's not a disorder, it's not an illness, it's just a different way of thinking, an alternative way to approach. Actually, no, alternative even implies that there's a norm. So there's just a spectrum of ways to think, and right? But the fact is, our society is so structured around neurotypical people that we still refer to having ADHD as a diagnosis, because that's really the only way we know how to talk about it, I feel. And then the fact that I have to take medications to function in a neurotypical society, it doesn't make me like depressed or anything. I just think it's an interesting thought. So how does taking medications, which betters your chance of success or quote unquote fixes you, right? Or it's like, how do you kind of connect that with the social model of disability, where nothing is broken, nothing is, but we still have to take meds to function in a traditional environment, which implies a lack or a failing of something?
Sure. Well, I think it depends on the person, because for me, I don't see, and the reason why I kind of laugh a little bit or giggle about this is because I view it more as like a performance enhancer than a medication. But it is, you know, in many ways it's a chemical imbalance, right? And one of the ways of trying to correct that is by taking medication.
Yeah.
But the stigma that comes with that, I think can be huge. But you know, a lot of people who are against medication or who don't necessarily believe in medication for things like ADHD also may not believe in medication for things like anxiety and depression. So it really, and my role really is not to promote medication. I'm not a doctor. Really in talking about medication, I share my experiences and what medication has done for me, but you know, the same medication that I take may have adverse effects for somebody else. So it really is a trial and error process that somebody would need to go through with their family physician to figure out, you know, which medication might be the right medication. And you know, then once you do find that, you've got to go back and forth between doses until you find that one. But it can be quite a process.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just a question that's been on my mind for several years, and it's hard to ask neurotypical people because they just don't inhabit that like mind, you know.
They don't, but I think that the bridge there it's narrowing, and one of the ways that, you know, one of the tips or tricks that I can share with you in how I assess people is that everybody knows somebody with a disability. Statistically, it's impossible not to.
Yeah.
If I'm talking to someone and I'm, you know, for back lack of a better term, I'm getting, you know, these ignorant vibes, then I'm just going to cut the conversation short. I'm not going to waste my time and energy with or on that person. So I think a lot of our self-preservation can be maintained by identifying when conversations or relationships aren't really going in the trajectory that are healthy and good for us. And kind of shifting directions. And I really try to, you know, impose on people, like, as long as you make it about somebody else, it can never be about you. And a lot of our time and energy is consumed thinking about what other people think or want, which kind of, it's like analysis paralysis, right? You can think about something for so long that it then just paralyzes you and things don't get done. So I think flipping that script and trying to get people to understand that it can be all about you. It's okay to be selfish. It's okay to put yourself first, and what that looks like, if it means that it's helping you to move forward. And sometimes that means that maybe you're not able to put as much energy or time into a relationship that may not be as healthy as the one you want to have with yourself.
Yeah. And kind of going off of that, where we, it's kind of not our responsibility to educate neurotypical people or to even pursue, you know, like, it's good to spread awareness, right? But it's emotionally taxing. Like you said, it can lead to toxic kind of conversations and relationships. So who, like, what kind of work can not even I do, but just people in general do to catalyze change, pot for the better.
Sure. Keep being awesome, man. No one ever said being awesome would be easy, and it's not. It's hard work, and it takes having those conversations and having somebody kind of take from your bucket to realize that you don't like that, right? And we all have people in our life, you know, like I'm at a place now in my life where my cup is always half full. It wasn't always that way, right? But we all have people in our lives for whom the cup is half empty. And no matter how hard they try to take from our cup, their cup will never be full. But at some point we have to ask ourselves, what do we get out of letting them try?
Yeah, and I think at this point in my life, cups, like, sometimes the cup ain't even there. Kind of hard to see a cup, whatever that's supposed to mean. But I think on some days, I mean, I think it's great that the cup is half full. But for me, it's like a day on, day off thing, you know? Sometimes the cup is a vacuum. Sometimes it's half empty, half full.
Yeah, and yeah. You know, to be honest, Jonathan, like when I was your age, the cup was non-existent. Somebody, I would have honestly felt like somebody stole that cup from me, and I have no idea where even to begin to look for it.
Yeah.
Sure. Goodbye, everyone, and thanks for the chat, Jonathan. It was great to finally connect with you.
Yeah, it's great to reconnect with you.
I'd like to thank Sean once again for chatting with me this week. Thank you to the Daily Campus and UCTV for collaborating with us, and thank you to Ethan Smith for our theme music. And thank you, listeners. I've been your host, Jonathan Kapoyovich, and you're listening to Wustora's 91.7 FM. Have a fantastic weekend.